You have multiple things going on, including a job, your poetry, this event. How do you manage all of these plates, plus a loving relationship and family time and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't always manage it, and I'm dropping the plates. They're smashing all over the place. But when it comes to my poetry, so that's my passion, just really try and make time for it. So I wake up early, I'll go to bed late, I'll seize the opportunity to do it when I have a any downtime. So you know those moments when you're compelled to Google what the Love Island cast from 2019 are up to now? Instead of doing that, go on, try and draft that poem that you've been wanting to draft for the last few weeks. You've got some time to do it. Make the most of it.
Hello, welcome to the first free episode of Going Places. I'm your host, Natalie Byrne, illustrator, small business owner, and author. This is a podcast aimed to give you clarity on your creativity because you, my friend, are going places. This is a continuation of my Patreon-only podcast, which is me sharing what I know. But these free episodes is me sitting down with a special guest, asking them about their journey, their creativity, and what they know. In today's episode, we are chatting to badass feminist poet My Hairy Vulva and me. Her poetry has been printed on the seats of London taxis, featured on Sky Arts BAFTA award-winning show Life and Rhymes, and heard at many badass feminist events. Her mission in life is to normalize conversations about bodies and mental health through humor and honesty. And on the 25th of May, with co-founder Vava Boom, we'll be launching Vagina Fest. Both lovers of words, poetry and creativity, and of course, shaking the vagina stigma. They have created a whole festival dedicated to gynecological rhythm and storytelling. So excited for the event. And here is my conversation with Emily, aka My Hairy Vulva and Me. Well, we were both on a panel like years ago where someone asked us if we, like, how we overcame our shame to do work on periods and things like that. And me and you both looked at each other. I remember this. I don't know. And we were both like, I still feel extreme shame, especially around my period. I still had my tampon up my sleeve when going to the toilet, and that we were still, like, that was actually the main like reason why we were doing the work, is because we feel that shame, like, we haven't completely overcome into a shameless being. And I wanted to know, do you still feel that way, and what's your relationship like with shame at the moment?
Yes, so I do still feel an immense shame when it comes to my monthly cycle. And look, I'm not embarrassed to say that. I've been force-fed this shame since I was a young girl. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it does feel nearly impossible to stop those automatic ways of thinking, that loop in my brain that tells me periods are disgusting, periods should be hidden, periods need to be kept secret. Especially, just think about the world we live in today. Like, so many barriers. We've overcome so many barriers when it comes to menstruation. We're talking about them more openly now. They come up in the media all the time. But when you are just simply looking for your menstrual products and you go to a supermarket or a pharmacy, and the aisle where you find these products is called feminine hygiene. Let's unpick that for a moment. So hygiene, that suggests that periods are unhygienic, that they need to be controlled. Periods are natural bodily function. And also, the use of the word feminine, let's go into that too while we're here, is problematic because it suggests that all women menstruate. They don't. And it also suggests that all people who menstruate are women. Now, we know that there are trans men who menstruate. Things are changing. I don't know if you're aware of this. So ASDA has already changed the names of their aisles. So they've changed from feminine hygiene to period products. And 4 days ago, Boots has joined the bandwagon. Incredible. Boots, this huge conglomerate, have joined the bandwagon and have also changed that aisle and are naming it period products. Mm. Brilliant. So that's just a small way in which we can try and remove that shame and stigma around menstruation.
Yeah, I agree. And how do you feel with like your amazing artwork? With, like, what's your relationship with shame when doing your amazing poetry and speaking?
Actually, that's an interesting question, because just before I perform, sometimes I like to change my lineup. You know, I might decide I'll do this poem about pubes. It feels relevant today. We'll do this poem about, you know, leaking all over an underground seat. And sometimes I look at the audience and I think, ooh, I don't think they're ready to hear about my heavy flow. I don't want to share that today. I'm not feeling like I'm okay to put myself in this vulnerable position to talk about this. But then the other side of my brain thinks, because you're feeling uncomfortable and because you're not feeling ready and you think that the audience don't want to hear it, then they absolutely do need to hear it. You know, and on some of those days, I feel braver than others. And I'll admit that sometimes I don't include that poem. And then, you know, that partly that's self-preservation. I need to take care of myself and feel okay on stage. But I'm still kind of working towards getting to a place where I'm ready to share those poems at any time, in any place.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting to hear you say that, because it's like everything I do is online and I never see anyone. Well, hardly ever. And I try, I like it that way. But what you do, I find so fascinating, because you really do look out into the audience, like you're looking into people's eyes. Emily, is an incredible, your delivery on your poetry is amazing and entertaining, and you're vulnerable, but you're funny, and it's a real, real honest stories, and also stories that people can relate to. Like, who hasn't leaked? Like, I don't know anyone that hasn't leaked. Well, anyone that has a period. And yeah, it's just such a wonderful experience to see you deliver the poems. And I wanted to ask you that question actually for ages. I wanted to go back to your first kind of experience writing a poem, and if you remember the first poem you wrote.
Yeah, I've got it here for you. I'm going to read it many moons ago. It's called Ode to Underwear. Why do models who advertise underwear made of translucent material that's barely there always have a baby smooth vulva with no flabby flaps? Did the outer labia and pubes go on holiday, perhaps? Now, that short poem is a protest against the unrealistic beauty standards perpetuated by advertising campaigns, obviously. And I would love to know, Natalie, when was the last time you saw meaty labia creating a silhouette in a underwear campaign for Calvin Klein, or when you saw pubes sprawling out of a swimsuit in, you know, H&M's latest summer campaign?
Never.
Where are they? Where are they? And it's so natural and so normal to have meaty labia, to have straggly pubes. Why do we pretend that they don't exist? And so when you reach puberty and your labia start growing and your pubes start growing, you think you're unnatural, that you're abnormal, that you have to hide it, that you have to wax and shave everything away so that you fit into this cookie cut mold of what a body should look like.
Yeah.
It's outrageous. And as I said, with periods, you know, times are changing and we're talking about pubes now more openly. So I don't know if you're aware, the razor brand Billy, like a couple of years ago, yeah, released that campaign where they had people walking around in their swimsuits and confidently flaunting their pubic hair, right? But Billy's still quite a kind of niche brand. We've got you've got the Gillettes of the world that need to tackle this taboo. And, you know, very oddly, I was looking at my phone today. I was on Instagram scrolling, wasting time, classic. And a Gillette ad came on my phone, and it was a person shaving their pubic hairs, and the pubes were visible. That happened today.
I feel and like I know which one you're talking about as well.
Wow, that felt like a moment. It felt like a moment. However, I feel torn about these kind of razor ads showing pubic hair, like, great, they're showing bodies as they naturally are. That's superb. However, there's still the message that you need to remove this hair.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking I was going to ask you, because I feel like it's all the exciting companies like Astrid, for example, have done an incredible job of showing body hair and being like the message of like, whatever you want to do with it, keep it, get rid of it, it's your choice. And it's very obvious that the bigger brands are also kind of being inspired by that message and bringing that into their campaigns now. And so there's this mixture of like, are they doing it to make sure they're not isolating themselves, or they like trying to keep up with the times? There's still the ultimate message of like, buy our product.
It is a razor. And for me, they're just tapping into the feminist capitalists like me, who think, wow, they're so thoughtful and they're so open-minded and they're so willing to break down these barriers by showing our bodies the way that they are naturally. But in fact, you're telling me to buy something whilst kind of, I feel like it's mind games a little bit. I don't know. It's consumerist feminism that sits a little uncomfortably with me. However, like, I do believe that hair removal is a choice. It absolutely is a choice. If you want to remove your hair, which I remove my armpit hair, yeah, of course, absolutely do it. I don't want to shame anyone or blame anyone for that choice. I just think we need to be a bit kind of savvy and kind of aware when these brands are using like feminist rhetoric to sell, you know, for example, hair removal products.
It's like feminist capitalism, isn't it? It's like those two things coming together. But yeah, it worries me that someone's going into the room being like, we need to also not be left behind and say this message as well. But that poem was really cool. When did you write the poem?
I wrote the poem, that must have been about 5 years ago. And I wrote it out of anger. I usually write my poetry when I'm feeling extreme emotions. When those feelings are raw, I feel ready to write a piece. So now I'm in my 30s. It feels like my biological clock and my reproductive system is on everyone's lips. You know, that's from family, friends, acquaintances. Everyone is constantly asking me if I'm pregnant.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that's also because I'm in a kind of long-term relationship.
Yeah. She married.
I'm married. And so I'm married, girl. There are a lot of assumptions about the life that I should lead. And I don't know if I'm being too precious. If someone asks, are you planning on having a child? Is that an offensive question? I mean, it is to me, because it suggests so many different things. One, that in order to be a fully fledged woman, I need to be a mother. Right? Am I not enough without being a mother? Number two, you don't know what my journey is. Like, it could be that I've had a miscarriage. It could be I'm infertile. It could be that I just don't want children, which is also okay. But it's complicated, and it's none of your business unless I bring it up first.
I feel
it's a very sensitive topic. Don't bring it up at the dinner table.
Please. Yeah, and also, does it? No, this is my food baby.
Yeah, I feel like their eyes are constantly looking at my belly, checking to see if I've had a sip of alcohol. Yeah, and I've written.
It sounds so invasive.
Yeah, it does, and I've written a poem about that recently, which is quite strongly worded. And the idea is that, like, my womb has been. I feel like my womb has been stolen by society. And it's the most precious part of me. It belongs to me and it's my business. And that's what the poem is about. It's a very angry poem.
I recently, I turned 30 and immediately overnight, I feel like I got all these adverts for like pregnancy stuff, like immediately. And I was like, whoa. And then even I've had some moments where I felt, because I really want kids, and I've always said that I really want kids, but I think there's something really difficult that when you turn 30 and maybe still figuring out yourself, and like, I'm still feel like I have nothing else focused on my mind than my creative business, that I got really frustrated that, like, the idea of having, because all the women in my family have had a menopause really early,
right?
And I had this like huge crisis moment where I was really sad, because I felt like there was a very thoughtful choice that I made to start my own business, that maybe I was going to prolong me being ready to be a mum. Yeah. I chose to like do something that I really want to do, and I had to remind myself that, like, I made a choice to prioritize my own happiness and my own goals and my own creativity. And I have to remember that there's nothing worth like not prioritizing your happiness.
Yeah,
I had to just like remind myself of that. And then just like, if anything was to happen and I don't feel like I'm ready till I'm 40 and I do have a menopause, that I will adopt, and having those real serious conversations with myself. And that like, also, I think when I was single, I had to go through another good talk with myself, learning that, like, if I don't become a mother, my life is filled with love. And that was a real thing I had to like hone myself. Like, you don't need to do that to have a beautiful life that's filled with love, like, to the brim. And I think that's really, really important. I think for me, I always also feel like I so want to make my own foundations, and I think that makes like me think, like, do I want to have a baby for the wrong reasons? And having these real serious conversations with myself. But I think turning 30, that was, it's just frustrating to think that something that I want so deeply is also attached to a time limit, potentially.
I know. And I think that women can have it all idea is such a myth. There are so many competing demands that we have in our life. Like you said, you know, growing your business has taken a lot of time, and you wanted to focus on that solely. And now you're 30 and you think, oh, and I'm in a stable relationship, I would like to have children. What does that mean for my business? I've got limited time. It just feels really challenging. Yeah, frustrating and hard to navigate, isn't it?
And I think the older I am, the more terrified I am of things, including like a big change, like having a family. But it's frustrating, because it's like, I think as a feminist, everything else I've been able to do has been like on my own accord.
Yeah.
And then it's like considering someone else in those decisions. I don't know. It's scary, isn't it? But I think people can have it all, but not all at the same time. There's that amazing phrase, which I love. But it's interesting that you bring up.
Something does have to give.
Yeah, compromise.
Yeah, something has to give. I think 30 is also a turning point. Well, it has been for me, because I felt this like renewed confidence and maturity.
Mm.
And I'm really ready to live my fullest life now.
I feel the same. I feel like I'm really enjoying. I feel confident. I know myself. Yeah. I've said no to things more than ever that I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
I think, because people say 30s are like the best time, and I feel like I'm feeling that. I had like a wobble, because that was when I spoke to my grandma, and she told me she had menopause really early, and then my mum also had menopause really early. But then I'm like, you know what? Some things are out of my control, and then that's it. And I always saw myself adopting. Like, it doesn't mean that if one route to have kids ends, it doesn't mean it's like the final chapter.
Absolutely.
I'd love to talk about your inspirations and things that inspire you, and who inspires you or what inspires you.
So there's a poet called Holly McNish who really inspires me, because I think she perfectly and vividly encapsulates what it's like to move through this world as a woman. And there's a poem she wrote called When I Was a Teenage Girl, and I've got an extract that I'd like to read to you.
Oh yes, but please,
in your own time, seek out the poem and read it, because it's so viscerally true. So this is an extract from When I Was a Teenage Girl by Holly McNish. I was told not to take the shortcut. I was told not to walk alone. I was told not to stay out late. I was told not to masturbate. I was told not to get pregnant. I was told not to get fingered. I was told not to be too sexy. I was told to be really sexy. I was told not to have sex. I was told to sing Hit Me Baby One More Time in uniform like hers. How are you feeling after?
So many like visuals came to my mind of my own like childhood and being told what to do. And that Britney Spears like music video that changed all our lives.
It changed all of our lives and made us feel like we needed to be sexy schoolgirls. But then the line in this poem, but not be too sexy, but not get fingered, not get pregnant, not masturbate. We're told to be these sexual beings, but then like shamed for being them. Yeah. And also not given the tools to be safe and confident and to know what was ours.
Exactly.
When to say no, what our boundaries were. This is all about what not to do, not what to do. I wish I was given the tools I needed to be like a safe, confident, comfortable young woman in her body.
Yeah, I got chills. I feel the same. And I feel like so many people feel the same. And I think there's like a sadness that can happen when you grow older and you do learn that like society has let you down or people have let you down, education's let you down because no one was having these conversations. And I remember feeling so angry. Not necessarily angry, but that feeling of feeling disappointed when I maybe should have been angry. I felt so heartbroken and disappointed when I was like, wait, it wasn't just this one thing. It was like, you know, every aspect, which is like educate school. I was also in the church and friends and family and, you know, so many opportunities for people to kind of have those conversations of like, this is how you can be safe, and like if this happens it's okay, and this is going to happen to your body and you're allowed to say no and all these things, which hopefully I feel like things are changing, but they're always going to be changing really slowly in that regard. I love that poem, and it makes so much sense that inspires you, because I feel like it's your poetry is so visual as well and takes me back into my own kind of experience. And I always feel like when I listen to poetry, especially in people speaking it, that for me, visuals come up to my mind. And I find that really moving.
Yeah, me too. That's why I wanted to share it with you. It felt like it perfectly encapsulates my experience of being a teenage girl. Devastating, but very true.
Yeah, your own poetry discusses like shame and taboos, and it's really honest and very relatable. I want to know when you started making that kind of poetry.
Yeah, so before I started writing my poetry, I wrote a scientific psychological paper that's about the relationship we have with our genitals. And as we know, as you and I know, Natalie, this relationship is too often fraught with anxiety and disgust, which has been shaped by how society puts this pressure on us to fashion our vulvas so they look smooth, pink, hairless, like a Barbie's. And I published this paper and I thought I'd done this amazing job for feminist kind. I thought I've really opened up the doors for us to have more honest conversations about the rich diversity of how labia can look and bodies can look. And this conversation around choice, around pubic hair maintenance. I mean, the word maintenance is maybe problematic, but you know, you choose whether or not you want to remove your pubic hair or not. That's very much your choice. Right. So I wrote that paper and I thought I'd done a a great job for Feminist Kind. Then I realized that it's behind this paywall, so you have to pay to access it, which means that not everyone can read it. And it's also written in this ridiculous, highfalutin scientific language. So it's not particularly accessible or easy to digest. And it was at that point that I thought I needed to create something that was more easily understood and just more fun. And I found poetry to be the perfect vehicle for that.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that I've asked you that, I remember before.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting that you tried like one thing and then kind of learned from it and was trying to eventually came to what you're doing now. I think it's so funny as well, because it's like, I think I remember you saying that and I was like, I want to read it. And yeah, it's very clear as well, like it's informed what you do now in terms of, I think, I imagine it would have taken a lot of research, which means that you know what you're talking about as well. And yeah, was that for university that you did that?
Yeah, it was.
And so it's nice that you got to, did you get to choose something that you were passionate about?
I did. The thing is, like, I chose that topic because I came across the vagina monologues in the library when I was supposed to be revising for my exams. And I just was addicted to this book, where I felt like, oh, finally, people are really talking about these things that I've always wanted to talk about, like masturbation. I've never spoken to anyone about masturbation. This was in my 20s. And it felt so liberating. And I want to somehow talk about our most private bodies. And for me, I realized that kind of how the vulva looks felt like an important journey for me to explore myself and to unpick, because there's so many pressures that society puts on us. You know, porn, our sexual partners tell us that it should look like this and look like that. You know, between 2002 and 2012, labiaplasties on the NHS have increased by 500%.
And they're young girls as well. I remember reading that, really young.
Yes. And that's, you know, that's a serious surgery. That's a shortening or reshaping of the labia minora, which are the flaps that are just outside the vaginal opening.
And it also impacts pleasure, doesn't it, as well?
Pleasure. And that's a serious surgery that you are willing to undertake because you feel like you are abnormal or that your body is wrong. You know, over 50% of 25 to 35 year olds do not attend their smear tests. So they're putting themselves at serious health risk. And the main reasons for this are because we feel like our bodies are too disgusting. You know, that, oh, we haven't shaved, so we can't go. Oh, it smells funny. No, we definitely can't go. That anxiety and disgust, although it may sound trivial, can actually lead to serious health consequences, mental health and kind of physical health consequences. Shocking. Absolutely. So I will continue to share my taboo busting poetry about labia and pubes and periods until we get to a better place with our bodies and we can talk more openly about them.
Absolutely. And I think you definitely helped me like figure out how to accept all those parts. Especially, I think there's a power in realizing like your insecurities about your body are not, you're not alone in that feeling. And when you're not alone in that feeling, it is a societal problem rather than like your body is wrong and your individual problem. I'd love to know about how you have become like learned to accept and fall in love with your body and what tips you would give to your younger self.
Oh, I mean, it's been a long time coming. When I was 11, you know, my big boobs came in, my big nose came in, and I was being sexualized for my big chest and was being mocked for my big nose. And I just felt so uncomfortable and awkward in my body. And so I kept quiet and I was shy. And it's only recently that I've decided to shed the cloak of people's opinions that I've been able to tap into my true confidence. And confidence is just about being who you really are and not being scared of that. Like, I'm a bit weird, I'm a bit eccentric, and that is who I am, and I will be unapologetically me.
Yes.
And I will communicate that through my poetry. I don't know if you know the one about, I feel like this one is a good one in that reflects my personality. I'm gonna share it now.
Oh, I'm excited.
Sometimes when I'm lonely, my long sweet pubes I twirl. It makes me feel mysterious, like Peter Andre's girl. For me, that's just about owning my long pubes in a humorous way. You know, love Peter Andre, who doesn't? But I'm not scared to be who I am and to be a bit silly and freaky and funny.
And I remember when that song came out, that was like, it was so sexy and sensual. I feel like he was like by a waterfall.
He was. He's so tan and so ripped.
I'd love to ask you about confidence. I get a lot of questions about creative confidence, and it was something I think for me I really struggled with, and I love learning from others, because so much of, like, when you share your poetry, your public speaking as well, I think you're the perfect person to ask this question about how do you build on your confidence and your creative confidence, and especially with public speaking, which I know is like the number one thing that most people are terrified about.
It takes time and it takes practice. So, you know, I used to be a cripplingly shy person who felt like the words that came out of my mouth didn't ever make sense. So it's taken time for me to feel more comfortable and confident. And part of that is ignoring what people say or think about you. But another part of that, and I think this is more like the poetic creative confidence, is adopting this persona. So my performance name is My Hairy Vulva and Me. And my hairy vulva in me is bold and brash and not scared to say what's on her mind. And so by having that other persona, I feel like I'm able to step into this confidence that I might not have in my day-to-day life. I also like to dress up in an exaggerated way, because that also feels like I'm this fierce force to be reckoned with. And that gives me confidence too. But yeah, I'm still shit scared before I go on stage.
Do you think it's about learning to become comfortable with the nerves and in the uncomfortableness with the practice? Yeah,
that is so true. It's becoming more comfortable with the discomfort, because you will feel uncomfortable probably every time you go up on stage to share a piece of poetry or to do a bit of public speaking. You know, take your time. Walk slowly to the stage. Sometimes that walk can feel like forever, but you do need to just take that breath and give yourself a moment to compose yourself. And when you get to the stage, take another breath, center yourself, make sure you're really grounded, and then deliver the badassery that you have in store for the audience.
I love that.
People will be bored. They will be checking their phones. They will be yawning, right? So I think another important part of when you're actually on there is don't let the audience determine how you feel about whatever you're sharing, if that makes sense.
Yes.
You be your own cheerleader. Absolutely. Irrespective of what the audience are doing, you cheer yourself on. You know, there have been poetry performances that I've done, you know, there are like 3 or 4 people in the audience and there should have been 50. But sometimes that feels a bit cringe. You think, oh God. But you need to give it as much gusto as you would if you're performing to 1,000 people or if you're in Wembley Arena.
Mm.
Sorry. What were you going to say?
I kind of like it when there's less.
Oh, for me, I feed off more people. That's interesting. Like, however many people there are in the audience, make it work for you. You keep that cheerleader inside you. Go, Natalie, you can do this. Yes, you got it. Yeah, you're smart, you're intelligent, you're creative, you're funny. look at you doing this. Look how brave you are to stand here and to share your innermost feelings and thoughts with these people. Go you.
Mm. Oh, I love that. And I love that you like hearing about it. And I think as well, I feel the same when I put on something like really fun and bright, and like that I have a few confidence outfits that I wear when I feel like I need the extra, you know, oomph to make me feel powerful in a moment. And so many great tips. And yeah, it's never gonna be like overcoming, I guess, like overcoming the shame. It's like overcoming the nerves of public speaking. Is it impossible? I feel like I've done so many now, and I'm still, I feel, yeah, comfortable in the uncomfortable, and at least prepared. I think preparing
is very helpful. Absolutely, definitely prepare. I think that will get you in a better place. But there's nothing wrong with having nerves, and unless it gets to a point where they're crippling you.
Yeah.
Right. And there's maybe some reflection you need to do outside of the performance space on that, or like some coping skills for that. But the nerves give you that energy to do your performance. That's why you're there.
Yeah. And it's a human feeling. It's normal. It's a
human feeling. And if you mess up on stage, that's absolutely fine. Just carry it. That's completely fine. Of course you do. There have been so many times where I forget my words on stage. And you just stand there and they'll come to you, or they won't. Or they won't. And you say, oh, well, that's the end of my performance tonight. You just have to kind of stand, sit with that discomfort, and that's okay. You know, next time will be better.
It happens as part of being.
It happens. Yeah. Not everything hangs on that one performance or that one speech you do. You are not the sum of that one moment. I think that's also a thing. Like, if you come away from something thinking, oh, I forgot my words, I really fucked up, that's the end, I can never do it again. No, that moment isn't the sum of you. There are so many other moments where you've said what you wanted to, or you felt that you really shared the message that you wanted to share. Hold on to those moments.
I love that. Talking about public speaking, it brings me perfectly seamlessly into my next question, which is the Vagina Fest that you are a co-founder of with LMA, aka Viva Womb. You are launching this amazing event on the 25th of May in London. Tell me about how the Vagina Fest came to be.
Right, so I met LMA, who's the co-founder, aka Vavavoom, at a writing workshop that she organized, and we immediately clicked. There's something about her honesty and kindness that really attracted me to her, and I thought, I need to be her friend. So afterwards, we became really close, and I shared with her the complicated relationship I have with my body. You know, I need to speak out about all the crap I've been conditioned to think about when it comes to periods, sex, and reproduction. And then because I was so vulnerable with her, she shared her story with me, which she speaks very openly about. So she has MRKH, which is, and I need to read this because it's hard to say, which is Meyer-Rottkansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome. So that's a syndrome that impacts the reproductive system, and that can manifest itself in different ways. But in May's case, it means she was born without a womb. And she actually has only recently started talking about this because she felt the need to speak out about how womanhood does not need to equal motherhood. You know, we are so often told, as we were saying earlier on, that being a mother is an essential part of being a woman, but being a woman can be so many different wonderful things. And so we both shared our stories, and we realized that what's important to us is to share those experiences that society tells us are unacceptable or unpalatable. And that's how the Vagina Fest was born. It's basically a space for us to celebrate stories that are shrouded in stigma, you know, stories about abortion, miscarriage, masturbation, menstruation, all of it, and do it in a very like thoughtful, kind, like brilliant, creative way. And that's why we're inviting spoken word artists. We've got drag artists. We have a badass feminist jazz troupe that are performing at this night. We're all smashing the stigma around these stories that we've been told to keep secret for too long.
I love that. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited. It's the first ever in real life Vagina Fest because we started it in lockdown. So we had a Zoom Vagina Fest, which sounds boring, like, oh God, not another Zoom meeting. But we had 500 plus attendees.
Oh, amazing.
We had Holly McNish, whose poem I read to you earlier when I was a teenage girl. It was so successful. It was such a night of solidarity and beauty and vulnerability. That sounds cheesy, but it really was. And it was also sadly around the time that Sarah Everard was murdered. So it felt like we needed that space to express how we truly felt. And now we are doing
hope as well.
Find hope and to lift each other up. I think that was the overwhelming feeling that audience members said they had, was that feeling of solidarity and love for their fellow human being. Yeah, so the Vagina Festival in real life is happening at the Vauxhall Tavern on Wednesday, the 25th of May. Doors at 7, show starts at 8. Oh, it's going to be spectacular. I can't wait.
I can't wait.
I just can't wait for it. It's going to be brilliant.
Yeah, I know it's something that you we were excited of before COVID, and then because of COVID, you've had to delay everything.
Oh, God, what a nightmare. COVID's really thwarted us. Damn you, Miss COVID. But we're back and we're badder than ever. We've got our Vagina Festival. Everyone is welcome. People of all genders. I know it says vagina in the title, but we used the word vagina because we wanted a word that we felt like was most drenched in stigma. What word can we use in our title to really get people's attention and to really be like, look, we're here and we're not scared. And we were like, oh, the vagina is the right word for this festival. It's the Vagina Festival. But that doesn't mean it's just for vagina owners. You know, it's for everyone.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm going to be there. And I'm so excited. I wanted to ask you about collaboration on this event. And as collaboration is something that I'm fascinated by. What does it mean to put on an event like this? Like, let's talk about organization, planning, and any tips and tricks that you would love to share, because I know a lot of people would love to you know, have these ideas, and then to actually make them be can be work. Or people don't know where to start.
Well, if you're collaborating with someone, it needs to be someone you trust and who has the same goal and vision as you. So when I met LMA, I thought, oh, I'm inspired by her and her mission to share her story, which, as I've said, as she said, is kind of shrouded in stigma and mystery, and to be really open about it. And that's also what I do through my storytelling. So we are aligned in our values, but also she's kind and caring and empathic and understanding, and I trust her because of that. Does that make sense? Like, automatically, I just felt like I could rely on her. Because we're talking about quite sensitive topics, you know, through this Vagina Festival, we've done a lot of soul searching. But you also need to find someone who compliments you. So I'm the organized, structured one. And I would say she is the one that's like brimming with ideas, quite spontaneous. And I help ground her, and she helps me kind of think a bit more positively and think bigger idea. Let's go for the dream, Emily. And we complement each other well in that way. One of the traps you can fall into if you're trying to start a venture with a friend is acting like friends in your interactions, in your like work interactions, which you need to try and avoid doing. You kind of need to park the friendship and make this a like professional relationship. Think of yourself like colleagues when you're talking about whatever it is you want to do. So in my case, it was organize a big festival. So we organize meetings. So we have a meeting, we have an agenda. You know, I send off minutes afterwards. We each have clear actions. You might save some time at the beginning to chat about kind of personal life, what's going on for us. But it's important for that not to slip too much into our professional conversations, because then it's really hard to keep each other like on our toes and make, you know, follow up. Hey, LMA, have you posted that Instagram post? You said you were going to do that last week. Or, you know, Emily, you promised me that you would research the budget for this and you just haven't done it. Like, you, we need to be able to challenge each other in those ways. And if you slip into the friendship mode, it's a bit hard to do that. I don't know if you've ever found that, but you do need to be confident enough to say, hey babe, like, we need to get back to them, otherwise we're looking unprofessional here.
Yeah,
you know,
100%.
It's so tricky, isn't it? And I think there's another thing. I think, where did I hear this? Maybe it was on a podcast, one of these podcasts where it's, you know, all these people starting startups or doing their whatever you call it, side hustles. It's probably a control alt delete thing, but they recommended that you use like a certain medium of contact for business. So look, we can chat like fun stuff on WhatsApp, but on Instagram we only do business.
Oh, that's a really good rule. I feel like that's going to be really helpful for me, actually.
Yeah. I'm very strict with that, and I should be better. LMA and I should be better at that, but I think that helps you know that if we're having a conversation on WhatsApp, this is fun. We're having a chat. We're catching up. But if I'm talking on Instagram, look, this is about business. We need to get back to our cabaret performer. We need to let the lighting designer know that we want kind of this sort of mood. All that stuff should be kept to Instagram.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's definitely a tip that I am going to use in my future collaborations for sure. And it does just mean like, I feel like sometimes there's this pull to like have to reply right away, but if everything is in my email, it feels very professional, whereas like WhatsApp is just like fun. That is very helpful. Oh, I have one more question. You have multiple things going on, including a job, your poetry, this event. How do you manage all of these plates, plus a loving relationship and family time and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't always manage it, and I am dropping the plates. They're smashing all over the place. But when it comes to my poetry, so that's my passion, I just really try and make time for it. So I wake up early, I'll go to bed late, I'll seize the opportunity to do it when I have a downtime. So you know those moments when you're compelled to Google what the Love Island cast from 2019 are up to now? Instead of doing that, go on, try and draft that poem that you've been wanting to draft for the last few weeks. You've got some time to do it. Make the most of it. But I don't always get it right, and you know, it can put strain on family relationships or kind of work, or you know, my relationship with my husband. You know, it's a constant balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm sure being in a relationship that supports you to follow your passions is helpful, because I know that he's come to your events and been in the vagina community, you know, surrounded by like tampon sweets. Remember those little tampon
event?
And he's just fully supporting you and loves seeing you go out and do that. And I imagine I know from personal experience that helps.
I'm so lucky to have a supportive partner. You know, he's helped me fix a glittery menstrual cup to my head. You know, he's helped me edit poems about, you know, my pubes that I've stuck to my menstrual pad. And, you know, he's brilliant. And I can tell that he enjoys being, you know, part of that world and kind of learning more about that world, which is wonderful, isn't it?
It's wonderful.
How about you, what's your relationship like with your partner when it comes to your work?
Oh, it's never been, I've never felt as supportive. And I think right from day one, he just thought it was really cool and it wasn't just like, oh, that's cool, let's move on to a conversation, wanted to know like all the details and like all about it. And it's just been really nice. Been really nice, rather than in other situations and relationships I've been made to feel like I have to make myself small and be kind of ashamed of it.
You shouldn't have to make yourself feel small. You could be the biggest, best version of yourself. And if your relationship allows you to do that, then that's a wonderful relationship. And I definitely feel that in mine.
Oh, I love that. I think that's a beautiful note to end on.
We're going places, man. We've been through a lot in the last few years.
We've been places and we are going places.
I like that. Yeah, we've been places and we're definitely going places. Pleasure to see you, my love.
It was lovely to speak to you, babe. And that's the episode. Thank you so much, Emily, for joining me on this episode and sharing such wonderful advice. If you're in London, please make sure to get to the amazing event that's happening on the 25th of May. All the tickets and information will be in the description of this episode. If you're looking for more podcasts like this, you can sign up to my Patreon for extra episodes of just being on my own, sharing what I know. Topics include organization, money, how to price, how to charge, information on running a shop, and pretty much everything I know is on there. So if you want to join the Going Places community, you can sign up to my Patreon, patreon.com/Natalie Byrne. That's B-Y-R-N-E. Thanks so much for listening. Please share on your socials. Let me know what you thought of this episode and who you want to hear from next. The next episode will be on the 1st of the next month. Hit your calendars, subscribe, and come and join the Going Places community. See you on the 1st of next month.